was produced. The train was coming steadily. We saw it far away, and I had an excitement so great that I cannot tell it. We saw steam from it, and then later came the noise of the whistle. Then it came, cho-cho-cho, cho-cho-cho, steadily larger and larger, and then, at the moment of the explosion, the front wheels of the engine rose up, and all of the earth seemed to rise in a great cloud of blackness and a roar, and the engine rose high in the cloud of dirt and of the wooden ties rising in the air as in a dream, and then it fell onto its side like a great wounded animal. And there was an explosion of white steam before the clods of the other explosion has ceased to fall on us, and the machina commenced to speak. Ta-ta-ta-ta! Went the gypsy, shaking his two clenched fists up and down in front of him, thumbs up on an imaginary machine gun.
Ta-ta-ta! Ta-ta-ta!
He exulted.
Never in my life have I seen such a thing. With the troops running from the train, and the machina speaking into them, and the men falling...
It was then that I put my hand on the machina in my excitement and discovered that the barrel burned, and at that moment the old woman slapped me on the side of the face and said,
"Shoot, you fool, shoot, or I will kick your brains in."
Then I commenced to shoot, but it was very hard to hold my gun steady, and the troops were running up the far hill. Later, after we had been down at the train to see what there was to take, an officer forced some troops back toward us at the point of a pistol. He kept waving the pistol and shouting at them, and we were all shooting at him, but no one hit him. Then some troops lay down and commenced firing, and the officer walked up and down behind them with his pistol, and still we could not hit him, and the machina could not fire on him because of the position of the train. This officer shot two men as they lay, and still they would not get up, and he was cursing them, and finally they got up, one, two, and three at a time, and came running toward us, and the train. Then they lay flat again and fired. Then we left, with the machina still speaking over us as we left. It was then I found the girl where she had run from the train to the rocks, and she ran with us. It was those troops who hunted us until that night.
It must have been something very hard, Anselmo said, of much emotion. It was the only good thing we have done, said a deep voice. What are you doing now, you lazy, drunken, obscene, unsayable son of an unnameable, unmarried gypsy obscenity? What are you doing?
Robert Jordan saw a woman of about 50, almost as big as Pablo, almost as wide as she was tall, in black peasant skirt and waist, with heavy wool socks on heavy legs, black rope-soled shoes, and a brown face like a model for a granite monument. She had big but nice-looking hands, and her thick, curly black hair was twisted into a knot on her neck.
"Answer me," she said to the gypsy, ignoring the others.
"I was talking to these comrades. This one comes as a dynamiter."
"I know all that," the mujer of Pablo said. "Get out of here now and relieve Andres, who is on guard at the top."
"Me voy," the gypsy said. "I go."
He turned to Robert Jordan.
"I will see thee at the hour of eating."
"Not even in a joke," said the woman to him. "Three times you have eaten today, according to my count. Go now and send me Andres."
"Hola," she said to Robert Jordan, and put out her hand and smiled. "How are you? And how is everything in the Republic?"
"Good," he said, and returned her strong hand grip, "both with me and with the Republic."
"I am happy," she told him. She was looking into his face and smiling, and he noticed she had fine gray eyes. "Do you come for us to do another train?"
"No," said Robert Jordan, trusting her instantly. "For a bridge."
"No es nada," she said. "A bridge is nothing. When do we do another train now that we have horses?"
"Later. This bridge is of great importance."
"The girl told me your comrade who was with us at the train is dead."
"Yes."
"What a pity. Never have I seen such an explosion. He was a man of talent. He pleased me very much. It is not possible to do another train now? There are many men here now in the hills, too many. It is already hard to get food. It would be better to get out, and we have horses.
We have to do this bridge."
"Where is it?"
"Quite close."
"All the better," the mujer of Pablo said. "Let us blow all the bridges there are here and get out. I am sick of this place. Here is too much concentration of people. No good can come of it. Here is a stagnation that is repugnant."
She sighted Pablo through the trees.
"Borracho!" she called to him. "Drunkard! Rotten drunkard!"
She turned back to Robert Jordan cheerfully.
"He's taken a leather wine bottle to drink alone in the woods," she said. "He's drinking all the time. This life is ruining him. Young man, I am very content that you have come." She clapped him on the back.
"Ah,"
she said. You're bigger than you look, and ran her hand over his shoulder, feeling the muscle under the flannel shirt.
Good. I am very content that you have come.
And I equally.
We will understand each other, she said. Have a cup of wine.
We have already had some, Robert Jordan said. But will you?
Not until dinner, she said. It gives me heartburn.
Then she sighted Pablo again.
Borracho!
She shouted.
Drunkard!
She turned to Robert Jordan and shook her head.
He was a very good man, she told him, but now he is terminated. And listen to me about another thing. Be very good and careful about the girl, the Maria. She has had a bad time. Understandest thou?
Yes. Why do you say this?
I saw how she was from seeing thee when she came into the cave. I saw her watching thee before she came out.
I joked with her a little.
She was in a very bad state, the woman of Pablo said. Now she is better. She ought to get out of here.
Clearly she can be sent through the lines with Anselmo.
You and the Anselmo can take her when this terminates.
Robert Jordan felt the ache in his throat, and his voice thickening.
That might be done, he said.
The mujer of Pablo looked at him and shook her head.
Ay, ay, she said. Are all men like that?
I said nothing. She is beautiful, you know that.
No, she is not beautiful.
But she begins to be beautiful, you mean, the woman of Pablo said.
Men. It is a shame to us women that we make them.
No, in seriousness. Are there not homes to care for such as her under the Republic? Yes, said Robert Jordan. Good places. On the coast, near Valencia. In other places, too. There they will treat her well, and she can work with children. There are the children from evacuated villages. They will teach her the work. That is what I want, the mujer of Pablo said. Pablo has a sickness for her already. It is another thing which destroys him. It lies on him like a sickness when he sees her. It is best that she goes now. We can take her after this is over.
And you will be careful of her now, if I trust you?
I speak to you as though I knew you for a long time. It is like that, Robert Jordan said, when people understand one another.
Sit down, the woman of Pablo said. I do not ask any promise, because what will happen. Only if you will not take her out, then I ask a promise.
Why if I would not take her?
Because I do not want her crazy here after you will go. I have had her crazy before, and I have enough without that.
We will take her after the bridge, Robert Jordan said. If we are alive after the bridge, we will take her.
I do not like to hear you speak in that manner. That manner of speaking never brings luck.
I spoke in that manner only to make a promise, Robert Jordan said. I am not of those who speak gloomily.
Let me see thy hand, the woman said.
Robert Jordan put his hand out, and the woman opened it, held it in her own big hand, rubbed her thumb over it, and looked at it carefully, then dropped it. She stood up. He got up too, and she looked at him without smiling. What did you see in it? Robert Jordan asked her. I don't believe in it. You won't scare me.
Nothing, she told him. I saw nothing in it.
Yes, you did. I am only curious. I do not believe in such things.
In what do you believe?
In many things, but not in that.
In what?
In my work?
Yes, I saw that.
Tell me what else you saw.
I saw nothing else, she said bitterly. The bridge is very difficult, you said?
No, I said it is very important.
But it can be difficult?
Yes. And now I go down to look at it. How many men have you here?
5 that are any good. The gypsy is worthless, although his intentions are good. He has a good heart. Pablo, I no longer trust.
How many men has El Sordo that are good?
Perhaps 8. We will see tonight. He is coming here. He is a very practical man. He also has some dynamite. Not very much, though. You will speak with him.
Have you sent for him?
He comes every night. He is a neighbor. Also a friend as well as a comrade.
What do you think of him?
He is a very good man. Also very practical. In the business of the train he was enormous.
And in the other bands?
Advising them in time, it should be possible to unite 50 rifles of a certain dependability.
How dependable?
Dependable within the gravity of the situation.
And how many cartridges per rifle?
Perhaps 20, depending on how many they would bring for this business, if they would come for this business. Remember thee that in this of a bridge there is no money and no loot, and in thy reservations of talking much danger, and that afterwards there must be a moving from these mountains. Many will oppose this of the bridge.
Clearly.
In this way it is better not to speak of it unnecessarily.
I am in accord.
Then after thou hast studied thy bridge, we will talk tonight with El Sordo.
I go down now with Anselmo.
Wake him then, she said.
Do you want a carbine?
Thank you, he told her.
It is good to have, but I will not use it. I go to look, not to make disturbances.
Thank you for what you have told me.
I like very much your way of speaking.
I try to speak frankly.
Then tell me what you saw on the hand.
No, she said, and shook her head. I saw nothing.
Go now to thy bridge. I will look after thy equipment.
Cover it, and that no one should touch it. It is better there than in the cave.
It shall be covered, and no one shall touch it, the woman of Pablo said.
Go now to thy bridge.
Anselmo, Robert Jordan said, putting his hand on the shoulder of the old man who lay sleeping, his head on his arms. The old man looked up.
Yes, he said. Of course, let us go.
Chapter 3 They came down the last 200 yards, moving carefully from tree to tree in the shadows, and now through the last pines of the steep hillside, the bridge was only 50 yards away. The late afternoon sun that still came over the brown shoulder of the mountain showed the bridge dark against the steep emptiness of the gorge. It was a steel bridge of a single span, and there was a sentry box at each end. It was wide enough for 2 motor cars to pass, and it spanned, in solid-flung metal grace, a deep gorge at the bottom of which, far below, a brook leaped in white water through rocks and boulders down to the main stream of the pass. The sun was in Robert Jordan's eyes, and the bridge showed only an outline. Then the sun lessened and was gone, and looking up through the trees at the brown, rounded height that it had gone behind, he saw now that he no longer looked into the glare, that the mountain slope was a delicate new green, and that there were patches of old snow under the crest. Then he was watching the bridge again in the sudden short trueness of the little light that would be left, and studying its construction. The problem of its demolition was not difficult. As he watched, he took out a notebook from his breast pocket and made several quick line sketches. As he made the drawings, he did not figure the charges. He would do that later. Now he was noting the points where the explosive should be placed in order to cut the support of the span and drop a section of it into the gorge. It could be done unhurriedly, scientifically, and correctly with a half dozen charges laid and braced to explode simultaneously, or it could be done roughly, with 2 big ones. They would need to be very big ones, on opposite sides, and should go at the same time. He sketched quickly and happily, glad at last to have the problem under his hand, glad at last actually to be engaged upon it. Then he shut his notebook, pushed the pencil into its leather holder in the edge of the flap, put the notebook in his pocket, and buttoned the pocket. While he had sketched, Anselmo had been watching the road, the bridge, and the sentry boxes. He thought they had come too close to the bridge for safety, and when the sketching was finished, he was relieved. As Robert Jordan buttoned the flap of his pocket and then lay flat behind the pine trunk, looking out from behind it, Anselmo put his hand on his elbow and pointed with one finger. In the sentry box that faced toward them up the road, the sentry was sitting holding his rifle, the bayonet fixed, between his knees. He was smoking a cigarette, and he wore a knitted cap and blanket-style cape. At 50 yards, you could not see anything about his face. Robert Jordan put up his field glasses, shading the lenses carefully with his cupped hands, even though there was now no sun to make a glint. And there was the rail of the bridge, as clear as though you could reach out and touch it, and there was the face of the sentry, so clear he could see the sunken cheeks, the ash on the cigarette, and the greasy shine of the bayonet. It was a peasant's face, the cheeks hollow under the high cheekbones, the beard stubbled, the eyes shaded by the heavy brows, big hands holding the rifle, heavy boots showing beneath the folds of the blanket cape. There was a worn, blackened leather wine bottle on the wall of the sentry box. There were some newspapers, and there was no telephone. There could, of course, be a telephone on the side he could not see, but there were no wires running from the box that were visible. A telephone line ran along the road, and its wires were carried over the bridge. There was a charcoal brazier outside the sentry box, made from an old petrol tin, with the top cut off and holes punched in it, which rested on 2 stones. but he held no fire. There were some fire-blackened, empty tins in the ashes under it. Robert Jordan handed the glasses to Anselmo, who lay flat beside him. The old man grinned and shook his head. He tapped his skull beside his eye with one finger.
Ya lo veo, he said in Spanish. I have seen him.
Speaking from the front of his mouth, with almost no movement of his lips, in a way that is quieter than any whisper. He looked at the sentry as Robert Jordan smiled at him, and pointing with one finger, drew the other across his throat. Robert Jordan nodded, but he did not smile. The sentry box at the far end of the bridge faced away from them, and down the road, and they could not see into it. The road, which was broad and oiled and well constructed, made a turn to the left at the far end of the bridge, and then swung out of sight around a curve to the right. At this point, it was enlarged from the old road to its present width by cutting into the solid bastion of the rock on the far side of the gorge, and its left, or western edge, looking down from the pass and the bridge, was marked and protected by a line of upright, cut blocks of stone, where its edge fell sheer away to the gorge. The gorge was almost a canyon here, where the brook that the bridge was flung over merged with the main stream of the pass.
And the other post? Robert Jordan asked Anselmo. 500 meters below that turn, in the roadmender's hut that is built into the side of the rock.
How many men? Robert Jordan asked. He was watching the sentry again with his glasses. The sentry rubbed his cigarette out on the plank wall of the box, then took a leather tobacco pouch from his pocket, opened the paper of the dead cigarette, and emptied the remnant of used tobacco into the pouch. The sentry stood up, leaned his rifle against the wall of the box, and stretched, then picked up his rifle, slung it over his shoulder, and walked out onto the bridge. Anselmo flattened on the ground, and Robert Jordan slipped his glasses into his shirt pocket and put his head well behind the pine tree.
There are 7 men and the corporal, Anselmo said, close to his ear. I informed myself from the gypsy.
We will go now as soon as he is quiet, Robert Jordan said. We are too close.
Hast thou seen what thou needest?
Yes, all that I need. It was getting cold quickly now, with the sun down, and the light was failing as the afterglow from the last sunlight on the mountains behind them faded.
How does it look to thee?
Anselmo said softly as they watched the sentry walk across the bridge toward the other box, his bayonet bright in the last of the afterglow, his figure unshapely in the blanket coat.
Very good, Robert Jordan said. Very, very good. I am glad, Anselmo said. Should we go? Now there is no chance that he sees us.
The sentry was standing, his back toward them, at the far end of the bridge. From the gorge came the noise of the stream and the boulders. Then through this noise came another noise, a steady, racketing drone, and they saw the sentry looking up, his knitted cap slanted back, and turning their heads and looking up they saw, high in the evening sky, 3 monoplanes in V formation, showing minute and silvery at that height where there was still sun, passing unbelievably quickly across the sky, their motors now throbbing steadily.
Ours?
Anselmo asked. They seem so, Robert Jordan said, but knew that at that height you never could be sure. They could be an evening patrol of either side. But you always said pursuit planes were ours because it made people feel better. Bombers were another matter. Anselmo evidently felt the same.
They are ours, he said. I recognize them. They are Moscas.
Good, said Robert Jordan. They seem to me to be Moscas, too.
They are Moscas, Anselmo said.
Robert Jordan could have put the glasses on them and been sure instantly, but he preferred not to. It made no difference to him who they were tonight, and if it pleased the old man to have them be ours, he did not want to take them away. Now, as they moved out of sight toward Segovia, they did not look to be the green, red-wing-tipped, low-wing Russian conversion of the Boeing P-32 that the Spaniards called Moscas. You could not see the colors, but the cut was wrong. No. It was a fascist patrol, coming home. The sentry was still standing at the far box with his back turned. Let us go, Robert Jordan said. He started up the hill, moving carefully and taking advantage of the cover until they were out of sight. Anselmo followed him, at 100 yards distance. When they were well out of sight of the bridge, he stopped and the old man came up and went into the lead, and climbed steadily through the pass, up the steep slope in the dark. "We have a formidable aviation," the old man said happily.
"Yes."
"And we will win."
"We have to win."
"Yes, and after we have won, you must come to hunt."
"To hunt what?"
"The boar, the bear, the wolf, the ibex."
"You like to hunt?"
"Yes, man. More than anything. We all hunt in my village."
"You do not like to hunt?"
"No,"
said Robert Jordan.
"I do not like to kill animals."
"With me it is the opposite," the old man said. "I do not like to kill men."
"Nobody does except those who are disturbed in the head," Robert Jordan said. "But I feel nothing against it when it is necessary, when it is for the cause."
"It is a different thing, though," Anselmo said. "In my house, when I had a house, and now I have no house, there were the tusks of boar I had shot in the lower forest. There were the hides of wolves I had shot, in the winter hunting them in the snow. One very big one I killed at dusk in the outskirts of the village on my way home one night in November. There were 4 wolf hides on the floor of my house. They were worn by stepping on them, but they were wolf hides. There were the horns of ibex that I had killed in the High Sierra, and there was an eagle, stuffed by an embalmer of birds of Avila, with his wings spread and eyes as yellow and real as the eyes of an eagle alive. It was a very beautiful thing, and all of those things gave me great pleasure to contemplate."
"Yes," said Robert Jordan.
"On the door of the church of my village was nailed the paw of a bear that I killed in the spring, finding him on a hillside in the snow, overturning a log with this same paw."
"When was this?"
6 years ago. "And every time I saw that paw, like the hand of a man, but with those long claws, dried and nailed through the palm to the door of the church, I received a pleasure."
"Of pride?"
"Of pride, of remembrance of the encounter with the bear on that hillside in the early spring. But of the killing of a man who is a man as we are, there is nothing good that remains."
"You can't nail his paw to the church," Robert Jordan said.
"No. Such a barbarity is unthinkable. Yet the hand of a man is like the paw of a bear."
"So is the chest of a man like the chest of a bear," Robert Jordan said. "With the hide removed from the bear, there are many similarities in the muscles."
"Yes," Anselmo said. "The gypsies believe the bear to be a brother of man."
"So do the Indians in America," Robert Jordan said. "And when they kill a bear, they apologize to him and ask his pardon. They put his skull in a tree and they ask him to forgive them before they leave it."
"The gypsies believe the bear to be a brother to man because he has the same body beneath his hide, because he drinks beer, because he enjoys music, and because he likes to dance."
"So also believe the Indians."
"Are the Indians then gypsies?"
"No, but they believe alike about the bear."
"Clearly.
The gypsies also believe he is a brother because he steals for pleasure." "Have you gypsy blood?"
"No, but I have seen much of them, and clearly since the movement more. There are many in the hills. To them it is not a sin to kill outside the tribe. They deny this, but it is true."
"Like the Moors?"
"Yes. But the gypsies have many laws they do not admit to having. In the war, many gypsies have become bad again, as they were in olden times."
"They do not understand why the war is made. They do not know for what we fight."
"No," Anselmo said. "They only know now there is a war and people may kill again as in the olden times without a surety of punishment."
"You have killed?" Robert Jordan asked, in the intimacy of the dark and of their day together.
"Yes, several times, but not with pleasure. To me it is a sin to kill a man, even fascists whom we must kill. To me there is a great difference between the bear and the man, and I do not believe the wizardry of the gypsies about the brotherhood with animals. No, I am against all killing of men."
"Yet you have killed?"
"Yes, and will again. But if I live later, I will try to live in such a way, doing no harm to anyone, that it will be forgiven."
"By whom?"
"Who knows? Since we do not have God here anymore, neither his Son nor the Holy Ghost, who forgives? I do not know."
"You have not God anymore?"
"No, man, certainly not. If there were God, never would he have permitted what I have seen with my eyes. Let them have God."
"They claim him."
"Clearly I miss him, having been brought up in religion. But now a man must be responsible to himself."
"Then it is thyself who will forgive thee for killing."
I believe so, Anselmo said. Since you put it clearly in that way, I believe that must be it. But with or without God, I think it is a sin to kill. To take the life of another is to me very grave. I will do it whenever necessary, but I am not of the race of Pablo. To win a war, we must kill our enemies. That has always been true. Clearly, in war we must kill. But I have very rare ideas, Anselmo said. They were walking now close together in the dark, and he spoke softly, sometimes turning his head as he climbed. I would not kill even a bishop. I would not kill a proprietor of any kind. I would make them work each day as we have worked in the fields, and as we work in the mountains with the timber all of the rest of their lives, so they would see what man is born to, that they should sleep where we sleep, that they should eat as we eat, but above all, that they should work. Thus they would learn. And they would survive to enslave thee again. To kill them teaches nothing, Anselmo said. You cannot exterminate them because from their seed comes more with greater hatred. Prison is nothing. Prison only makes hatred. That all our enemies should learn. But still thou hast killed. Yes, Anselmo said, many times and will again, but not with pleasure, and regarding it as a sin. And the sentry? You joked of killing the sentry. That was in joke. I would kill the sentry, yes, certainly and with a clear heart considering our task, but not with pleasure. We will leave them to those who enjoy it, Robert Jordan said. There are 8 and 5, that is 13 for those who enjoy it. There are many of those who enjoy it, Anselmo said in the dark. We have many of those. More of those than of men who would serve for a battle. Hast thou ever been in a battle? Nay, the old man said. We fought in Segovia at the start of the movement, but we were beaten and we ran. I ran with the others. We did not truly understand what we were doing, nor how it should be done. Also, I had only a shotgun with cartridges of large buckshot, and the Guardia Civil had Mausers. I could not hit them with buckshot at 100 yards, and at 300 yards they shot us as they wished, as though we were rabbits. They shot much and well, and we were like sheep before them. He was silent, then asked, Thinkest thou there will be a battle at the bridge? There is a chance. I have never seen a battle without running, Anselmo said. I do not know how I would comport myself. I am an old man, and I have wondered. I will respond for thee, Robert Jordan told him. And hast thou been in many battles?
Several.
And what thinkest thou of this of the bridge?
First I think of the bridge. That is my business. It is not difficult to destroy the bridge. Then we will make the dispositions for the rest, for the preliminaries. It will all be written.
Very few of these people read, Anselmo said.
It will be written for everyone's knowledge so that all know, but also it will be clearly explained.
I will do that to which I am assigned, Anselmo said. But remembering the shooting in Segovia, if there is to be a battle or even much exchanging of shots, I would wish to have it very clear what I must do under all circumstances to avoid running. I remember that I had a great tendency to run at Segovia.
We will be together, Robert Jordan told him. I will tell you what there is to do at all times.
Then there is no problem, Anselmo said. I can do anything that I am ordered.
For us will be the bridge and the battle, should there be one, Robert Jordan said, and saying it in the dark he felt a little theatrical, but it sounded well in Spanish.
It should be of the highest interest, Anselmo said, and hearing him say it honestly and clearly, and with no pose, neither the English pose of understatement nor any Latin bravado, Robert Jordan thought he was very lucky to have this old man, and having seen the bridge and worked out and simplified the problem, it would have been to surprise the posts and blow it in a normal way. He resented Goltz's orders and the necessity for them. He resented them for what they could do to him, and for what they could do to this old man. They were bad orders, all right, for those who would have to carry them out.
And that is not the way to think, he told himself, and there is not you, and there are no people that things must not happen to. Neither you nor this old man is anything. You are instruments to do your duty. There are necessary orders that are no fault of yours, and there is a bridge, and that bridge can be the point on which the future of the human race can turn, as it can turn on everything that happens in this war. You have only one thing to do, and you must do it. Only one thing, hell, he thought,
If it were one thing, it was easy. "Stop worrying, you windy bastard," he said to himself. "Think about something else." So he thought about the girl, Maria, with her skin, the hair and the eyes all the same golden, tawny brown, the hair a little darker than the rest, but it would be lighter as her skin tanned deeper, the smooth skin, pale gold on the surface with a darkness underneath. Smooth it would be, all of her body smooth. And she moved awkwardly, as though there were something of her and about her that embarrassed her, as though it were visible, though it was not, but only in her mind. And she blushed when he looked at her, and she sitting, her hands clasped around her knees, and the shirt open at the throat, the cup of her breasts up-tilted against the shirt. And as he thought of her, his throat was choky, and there was a difficulty in walking, and he and Anselmo spoke no more until the old man said, "Now we go down through these rocks and to the camp." As they came through the rocks in the dark, a man spoke to them.
"Halt! Who goes?"
They heard a rifle bolt snick as it was drawn back, and then the knock against the wood as it was pushed forward and down on the stock.
"Comrades," Anselmo said.
"What comrades?"
"Comrades of Pablo," the old man told him. "Dost thou not know us?"
"Yes," the voice said. "But it is an order. Have you the password?"
"No, we come from below."
"I know,"
the man said in the dark.
"You come from the bridge. I know all of that. The order is not mine. You must know the second half of a password."
"What is the first half, then?" Robert Jordan said.
"I have forgotten it," the man said in the dark and laughed. "Go then unprintably to the campfire with thy obscene dynamite."
"That is called guerrilla discipline," Anselmo said. "Uncock thy piece."
"It is uncocked," the man said in the dark. "I let it down with my thumb and forefinger."
"Thou wilt do that with a Mauser sometime which has no knurl on the bolt and it will fire."
"This is a Mauser," the man said, "but I have a grip of thumb and forefinger beyond description. Always I let it down that way."
"Where is the rifle pointed?" asked Anselmo into the dark.
"At thee," the man said, "all the time that I descended the bolt. And when thou comest to the camp, order that someone should relieve me because I have indescribable and unprintable hunger and I have forgotten a password."
"How art thou called?" Robert Jordan asked.
"Augustine," the man said. "I am called Augustine, and I am dying with boredom in this spot."
"We will take the message," Robert Jordan said, and he thought how the word aburrimiento, which means boredom in Spanish, was a word no peasant would use in any other language. Yet it is one of the most common words in the mouth of a Spaniard of any class.
"Listen to me," Augustine said,
and coming close he put his hand on Robert Jordan's shoulder. Then striking a flint and steel together, he held it up, and blowing on the end of a cork, looked at the young man's face in its glow.
"You look like the other one," he said, "but something different. Listen."
He put the lighter down and stood holding his rifle.
"Tell me this. Is it true about the bridge?"
"What about the bridge?"
"That we blow up an obscene bridge and then have to obscenely well obscenity ourselves off out of these mountains?"
"I know not."
"You know not," Augustine said. "What a barbarity. Whose then is the dynamite?"
"Mine."
"And knowest thou not what it is for? Don't tell me tales."
"I know what it is for, and so will you in time," Robert Jordan said. "But now we go to the camp."
"Go to the unprintable," Augustine said, "and unprint thyself. But do you want me to tell you something of service to you?"
"Yes," said Robert Jordan, "if it is not unprintable," naming the principal obscenity that had larded the conversation. The man, Augustine, spoke so obscenely, coupling an obscenity to every noun as an adjective, using the same obscenity as a verb, that Robert Jordan wondered if he could speak a straight sentence. Augustine laughed in the dark when he heard the word.
"It is a way of speaking I have. Maybe it is ugly, who knows? Each one speaks according to his manner. Listen to me. The bridge is nothing to me. As well, the bridge is another thing. Also, I have a boredom in these mountains. That we should go if it is needed. These mountains say nothing to me. That we should leave them. But I would say one thing. Guard well thy explosive."
"Thank you," Robert Jordan said. "From thee?"
"No," Augustine said. "From people less unprintably equipped than I."
"So?" asked Robert Jordan.
"You understand Spanish," Augustine said seriously now. "Care well for thy unprintable explosive."
"Thank you."
No, don't thank me. Look after thy stuff.
Has anything happened to it?
No, or I would not waste thy time talking in this fashion.
Thank you all the same. We go now to camp.
Good, said Augustine. And that they send someone here who knows the password.
Will we see you at the camp?
Yes, man, and shortly.
Come on, Robert Jordan said to Anselmo.
They were walking down the edge of the meadow now, and there was a gray mist. The grass was lush underfoot after the pine needle floor of the forest, and the dew on the grass wet through their canvas rope-soled shoes. Ahead, through the trees, Robert Jordan could see a light where he knew the mouth of the cave must be.
Augustine is a very good man, Anselmo said. He speaks very filthily, and always in jokes, but he is a very serious man.
You know him well?
Yes, for a long time. I have much confidence in him.
And what he says?
Yes, man. This Pablo is bad now, as you could see.
And the best thing to do?
One shall guard it at all times.
Who?
You, me, the woman, and Augustine, since he sees the danger.
Did you think things were as bad as they are here?
No, Anselmo said. They have gone bad very fast. But it was necessary to come here. This is the country of Pablo and of El Sordo. In their country, we must deal with them unless it is something that can be done alone.
And El Sordo?
Good, Anselmo said. As good as the other is bad.
You believe now that he is truly bad?
All afternoon I have thought of it, and since we have heard what we have heard, I think now, yes, truly.
It would not be better to leave, speaking of another bridge, and obtain men from other bands?
No, Anselmo said. This is his country. You could not move that he would not know it. But one must move with much precautions.
Chapter 4 They came down to the mouth of the cave, where a light shone out from the edge of a blanket that hung over the opening. The two packs were at the foot of the tree covered with a canvas, and Robert Jordan knelt down and felt the canvas wet and stiff over them. In the dark he felt under the canvas in the outside pocket of one of the packs, and took out a leather-covered flask and slipped it in his pocket. Unlocking the long barred padlocks that passed through the grommet that closed the opening of the mouth of the packs, and untying the drawstring at the top of each pack, he felt inside them and verified their contents with his hands. Deep in one pack he felt the bundled blocks in the sacks wrapped in the sleeping robe, and tying the strings of that and pushing the lock shut again, he put his hands into the other and felt the sharp wood outline of the box of the old exploder, the cigar box with the caps, each little cylinder wrapped round and round with its two wires, the lot of them packed as carefully as he had packed his collection of wild bird eggs when he was a boy. The stock of the submachine gun, disconnected from the barrel and wrapped in his leather jacket. The two pans and five clips in one of the inner pockets of the big pack sack, and the small coils of copper wire and the big coil of light insulated wire in the other. In the pocket with the wire he felt his pliers, and the two wooden awls for making holes in the end of the blocks, and then from the last inside pocket he took a big box of Russian cigarettes of the lot he had from Goltz's headquarters, and tying the mouth of the pack shut, he pushed the lock in, buckled the flaps down, and again covered both packs with the canvas. Anselmo had gone on into the cave. Robert Jordan stood up to follow him, then reconsidered, and lifting the canvas off the two packs, picked them up, one in each hand, and started with them, just able to carry them, for the mouth of the cave. He laid one pack down and lifted the blanket aside, then with his head stooped and with a pack in each hand, carrying by the leather shoulder straps, he went into the cave. It was warm and smoky in the cave. There was a table along one wall with a tallow candle stuck in a bottle on it, and at the table were seated Pablo, three men he did not know, and the gypsy, Raphael. The candle made shadows on the wall behind the men, and Anselmo stood where he had come in to the right of the table. The wife of Pablo was standing over the charcoal fire on the open fire hearth in the corner of the cave. The girl knelt by her, stirring in an iron pot. She lifted the wooden spoon out and looked at Robert Jordan as he stood there in the doorway, and he saw in the glow from the fire the woman was blowing with a bellows the girl's face, her arm, and the drops running down from the spoon and dropping into the iron pot.
"What do you carry?" Pablo said.
"My things," Robert Jordan said, and set the two packs down a little way apart where the cave opened out on the side away from the table.
"Are they not well outside?" Pablo asked.
"Someone might trip over them in the dark," Robert Jordan said, and walked over to the table and laid the box of cigarettes on it.
"I do not like to have dynamite here in the cave," Pablo said.
"It is far from the fire," Robert Jordan said. "Take some cigarettes." He ran his thumbnail along the side of the paper box with the big colored figure of a warship on the cover and pushed the box toward Pablo. Anselmo brought him a rawhide-covered stool, and he sat down at the table. Pablo looked at him as though he were going to speak again, then reached for the cigarettes. Robert Jordan pushed them toward the others. He was not looking at them yet. But he noted one man took cigarettes and two did not. All of his concentration was on Pablo.
"How goes it, Gypsy?" he said to Raphael.
"Good,"
the Gypsy said. Robert Jordan could tell they had been talking about him when he came in. Even the Gypsy was not at ease.
"She is going to let you eat again?" Robert Jordan asked the Gypsy.
"Yes, why not?"
the Gypsy said. It was a long way from the friendly joking they had together in the afternoon. The woman of Pablo said nothing and went on blowing up the coals of the fire.
"One called Augustine says he dies of boredom above," Robert Jordan said.
"That doesn't kill," Pablo said. "Let him die a little."
"Is there wine?" Robert Jordan asked the table at large, leaning forward, his hands on the table.
"There is little left," Pablo said sullenly.
Robert Jordan decided he had better look at the other three and try to see where he stood.
"In that case, let me have a cup of water."
"Thou," he called to the girl, "bring me a cup of water." The girl looked at the woman, who said nothing, and gave no sign of having heard. Then she went to a kettle containing water and dipped a cupful. She brought it to the table and put it down before him. Robert Jordan smiled at her. At the same time, he sucked in on his stomach muscles and swung a little to the left on his stool so that his pistol slipped around on his belt, closer to where he wanted it. He reached his hand down toward his hip pocket, and Pablo watched him. He knew they were all watching him, too, but he watched only Pablo. His hand came up from the hip pocket with the leather-covered flask, and he unscrewed the top, and then, lifting the cup, drank half the water and poured very slowly from the flask into the cup.
"It is too strong for thee, or I would give thee some," he said to the girl, and smiled at her again.
"There is little left, or I would offer some to thee," he said to Pablo.
"I do not like anise," Pablo said.
The acrid smell had carried across the table, and he had picked out the one familiar component.
"Good," said Robert Jordan, "because there is very little left."
"What drink is that?"
the Gypsy asked.
"A medicine," Robert Jordan said. "Do you want to taste it?"
"What is it for?"
"For everything," Robert Jordan said. "It cures everything. If you have anything wrong, this will cure it."
"Let me taste it,"
the Gypsy said.
Robert Jordan pushed the cup toward him. It was a milky yellow now with the water, and he hoped the Gypsy would not take more than a swallow. There was very little of it left, and one cup of it took the place of the evening papers, of all the old evenings in cafes, of all chestnut trees that would be in bloom now in this month, of the great slow horses of the outer boulevards, of bookshops, of kiosks, and of galleries, of the Parc Montsouris, of the Stade Buffalo, and of the Butte Chaumont, of the Guarantee Trust Company, and the Ile de la Cité, of Foyot's old hotel, and of being able to read and relax in the evening, of all the things he had enjoyed and forgotten, and that came back to him when he tasted that opaque, bitter, tongue-numbing, brain-warming, stomach-warming, idea-changing liquid alchemy. The Gypsy made a face and handed the cup back.
"It smells of anise, but it is bitter as gall," he said. "It is better to be sick than have that medicine."
"That's the wormwood," Robert Jordan told him. "In this, the real absinthe, there is wormwood. It's supposed to rot your brain out, but I don't believe it. It only changes the ideas. You should pour water into it very slowly, a few drops at a time. But I poured it into the water."
"What are you saying?" Pablo said angrily, feeling the mockery.
"Explaining the medicine,"
Robert Jordan told him, and grinned. I bought it in Madrid. It was the last bottle, and it's lasted me 3 weeks. He took a big swallow of it, and felt it coasting over his tongue in delicate anesthesia. He looked at Pablo and grinned again. How's business? He asked. Pablo did not answer, and Robert Jordan looked carefully at the other three men at the table. One had a large, flat face, flat and brown as a Serrano ham, with a nose flattened and broken, and the long, thin Russian cigarette, projecting at an angle, made the face look even flatter. This man had short gray hair and a gray stubble of beard, and wore the usual black smock buttoned at the neck. He looked down at the table when Robert Jordan looked at him, but his eyes were steady, and they did not blink. The other two were evidently brothers. They looked much alike and were both short, heavily built, dark-haired, their hair growing low on their foreheads, dark-eyed and brown. One had a scar across his forehead above his left eye, and as he looked at them, they looked back at him steadily. One looked to be about 26 or 8, the other perhaps 2 years older.
What are you looking at? One brother, the one with the scar, asked.
V? Robert Jordan said.
Do you see anything rare?
No, said Robert Jordan. Have a cigarette.
Why not?
The brother said. He had not taken any before.
These are like the other had, he of the train.
Were you at the train?
We were all at the train, the brother said quietly. All except the old man.
That is what we should do now, Pablo said. Another train.
We can do that, Robert Jordan said. After the bridge. He could see that the wife of Pablo had turned now from the fire and was listening. When he said the word bridge, everyone was quiet. After the bridge, he said again deliberately, and took a sip of the absinthe. I might as well bring it on, he thought. It's coming anyway.
I do not go for the bridge, Pablo said, looking down at the table. Neither me nor my people.
Robert Jordan said nothing. He looked at Anselmo and raised the cup.
Then we shall do it alone, old one, he said, and smiled. Without this coward, Anselmo said.
What did you say? Pablo spoke to the old man.
Nothing for thee. I did not speak to thee,
Anselmo told him. Robert Jordan now looked past the table to where the wife of Pablo was standing by the fire. She had said nothing yet, nor given any sign. But now she said something he could not hear to the girl, and the girl rose from the cooking fire, slipped along the wall, opened the blanket that hung over the mouth of the cave, and went out.
I think it is going to come now, Robert Jordan thought. I believe this is it. I did not want it to be this way, but this seems to be the way it is.
Then we will do the bridge without thy aid, Robert Jordan said to Pablo.
No, Pablo said, and Robert Jordan watched his face sweat.
Thou wilt blow no bridge here.
No?
Thou wilt blow no bridge, Pablo said heavily.
And thou?
Robert Jordan spoke to the wife of Pablo, who was standing still and huge by the fire. She turned toward them and said,
I am for the bridge.
Her face was lit by the fire, and it was flushed, and it shone warm and dark and handsome now in the firelight, as it was meant to be.
What do you say?
Pablo said to her, and Robert Jordan saw the betrayed look on his face and the sweat on his forehead as he turned his head.
I am for the bridge and against thee, the wife of Pablo said. Nothing more.
I am also for the bridge, the man with the flat face and the broken nose said, crushing the end of the cigarette on the table.
To me the bridge means nothing, one of the brothers said. I am for the mujer of Pablo.
Equally,
said the other brother.
Equally,
the gypsy said. Robert Jordan watched Pablo, and as he watched, letting his right hand hang lower and lower, ready if it should be necessary, half hoping it would be, feeling perhaps that were the simplest and easiest, yet not wishing to spoil what had gone so well, knowing how quickly all of a family, all of a clan, all of a band can turn against a stranger in a quarrel, yet thinking what could be done with the hand were the simplest and best and surgically the most sound now that this had happened, saw also the wife of Pablo standing there, and watched her blush proudly and soundly and healthily as the allegiances were given.
I am for the Republic, the woman of Pablo said happily, and the Republic is the bridge. Afterwards we will have time for other projects.
And thou, Pablo said bitterly, with your head of a seed bull and your heart of a whore, thou thinkest there will be an afterwards from this bridge? Thou hast an idea of that which will pass?
That which must pass, the woman of Pablo said. That which must pass will pass.
And it means nothing to thee to be hunted then like a beast, after this thing from which we derive no profit, nor to die in it?
Nothing, the woman of Pablo said. And do not try to frighten me, coward.
Coward, Pablo said bitterly. You treat a man as coward because he has a tactical sense, because he can see the results of an idiocy in advance. It is not cowardly to know what is foolish.
Neither is it foolish to know what is cowardly, said Anselmo, unable to resist making the phrase.
Do you want to die? Pablo said to him seriously,
and Robert Jordan saw how unrhetorical was the question.
No? Then watch thy mouth. You talk too much about things you do not understand. Don't you see that this is serious? He said almost pitifully. Am I the only one who sees the seriousness of this?
I believe so, Robert Jordan thought. Old Pablo, old boy, I believe so. Except me. You can see it, and I see it. And the woman read it in my hand, but she doesn't see it, yet. Not yet she doesn't see it.
Am I a leader for nothing? Pablo asked. I know what I speak of. You others do not know. This old man talks nonsense. He is an old man who is nothing but a messenger and a guide for foreigners. This foreigner comes here to do a thing for the good of the foreigners. For his good we must be sacrificed. I am for the good and the safety of all.
Safety, the wife of Pablo said. There is no such thing as safety. There are so many seeking safety here now that they make a great danger. In seeking safety now you lose all. She stood now by the table with the big spoon in her hand.
There is safety, Pablo said. Within the danger there is the safety of knowing what chances to take. It is like the bullfighter who, knowing what he is doing, takes no chances and is safe.
Until he is gored, the woman said bitterly. How many times have I heard matadors talk like that before they took a goring? How often have I heard Finito say that it is all knowledge, and that the bull never gored the man, rather the man gored himself on the horn of the bull? Always do they talk that way in their arrogance before a goring. Afterwards we visit them in the clinic. Now she was mimicking a visit to a bedside. Hello, old-timer, hello, she boomed. Then,
Buenos, compadre, how goes it, Pilar?
Imitating the weak voice of the wounded bullfighter.
How did this happen, Finito? Chico, how did this dirty accident occur to thee?
Booming it out in her own voice, then talking weak and small.
It is nothing, woman. Pilar, it is nothing. It shouldn't have happened. I killed him very well, you understand? Nobody could have killed him better. Then having killed him exactly as I should, and him absolutely dead, swaying on his legs, and ready to fall of his own weight, I walked away from him with a certain amount of arrogance and much style, and from the back he throws me this horn between the cheeks of my buttocks, and it comes out of my liver.
She commenced to laugh, dropping the imitation of the almost effeminate bullfighter's voice, and booming again now.
You and your safety. Did I live 9 years with 3 of the worst-paid matadors in the world, not to learn about fear and about safety? Speak to me of anything but safety. And thee, what illusions I put in thee, and how they have turned out. From 1 year of war thou hast become lazy, a drunkard, and a coward.
In that way thou hast no right to speak, Pablo said, and less even before the people and the stranger.
In that way will I speak, the wife of Pablo went on. Have you not heard? Do you still believe that you command here?
Yes, Pablo said. Here I command.
Not in joke, the woman said. Here I command. Haven't you heard la gente? Here no one commands but me. You can stay if you wish, and eat of the food and drink of the wine, but not too bloody much, and share in the work if thee wishes, but here I command.
I should shoot thee and the foreigner both, Pablo said sullenly.
Try it, the woman said, and see what happens.
A cup of water for me, Robert Jordan said, not taking his eyes from the man with his sullen, heavy head, and the woman standing proudly and confidently holding the big spoon as authoritatively as though it were a baton.
Maria, called the woman of Pablo, and when the girl came in the door she said, Water for this comrade.
Robert Jordan reached for his flask, and bringing the flask out, as he brought it, he loosened the pistol in the holster and swung it on top of his thigh. He poured a second absinthe into his cup and took the cup of water the girl brought him and commenced to drip it into the cup, a little at a time. The girl stood at his elbow, watching him.
"Outside," the woman of Pablo said to her, gesturing with the spoon.
"It is cold outside," the girl said, her cheek close to Robert Jordan's, watching what was happening in the cup where the liquor was clouding.
"Maybe," the woman of Pablo said, "but in here it is too hot."
Then she said kindly, "It is not for long." The girl shook her head and went out. "I don't think he is going to take this much more," Robert Jordan thought to himself. He held the cup in one hand, and his other hand rested, frankly now, on the pistol. He had slipped the safety catch, and he felt the worn comfort of the checked grip, chafed almost smooth, and touched the round, cool companionship of the trigger guard. Pablo no longer looked at him, but only at the woman. She went on.
"Listen to me, drunkard. You understand who commands here?"
"I command."
"No, listen. Take the wax from thy hairy ears. Listen well. I command."
Pablo looked at her, and you could tell nothing of what he was thinking by his face. He looked at her quite deliberately, and then he looked across the table at Robert Jordan. He looked at him a long time, contemplatively, and then he looked back at the woman again.
"All right. You command," he said. "And if you want, he can command too. And the two of you can go to hell."
He was looking the woman straight in the face, and he was neither dominated by her, nor seemed to be much affected by her.
"It is possible that I am lazy and that I drink too much. You may consider me a coward, but there you are mistaken. But I am not stupid." He paused. "That you should command, and that you should like it. And now if you are a woman as well as a commander, that we should have something to eat."
"Maria," the woman of Pablo called. The girl put her head inside the blanket across the cave mouth.
"Enter now, and serve the supper."
The girl came in and walked across to the low table by the hearth, and picked up the enameled ware bowls and brought them to the table.
"There is wine enough for all," the woman of Pablo said to Robert Jordan. "Pay no attention to what that drunkard says. When this is finished, we will get more. Finish that rare thing thou art drinking, and take a cup of wine."
Robert Jordan swallowed down the last of the absinthe, feeling it gulped that way, making a warm, small, fume-rising, wet, chemical-change-producing heat in him, and passed the cup for wine. The girl dipped it full for him and smiled.
"Well, did you see the bridge?"
the gypsy asked. The others, who had not opened their mouths after the change of allegiance, were all leaning forward to listen now.
"Yes," Robert Jordan said. "It is something easy to do. Would you like me to show you?"
"Yes, man, with much interest."
Robert Jordan took out the notebook from his shirt pocket and showed them the sketches.
"Look how it seems," the flat-faced man who was named Primitivo said. "It is the bridge itself."
Robert Jordan, with the point of the pencil, explained how the bridge should be blown and the reason for the placing of the charges.
"What simplicity,"
the scarred-faced brother, who was called Andres, said.
"And how do you explode them?"
Robert Jordan explained that too, and as he showed them, he felt the girl's arm resting on his shoulder as she looked. The woman of Pablo was watching too. Only Pablo took no interest, sitting by himself with a cup of wine that he replenished by dipping into the big bowl Maria had filled from the wineskin that hung to the left of the entrance to the cave.
"Hast thou done much of this?"
the girl asked Robert Jordan softly.
"Yes."
"And can we see the doing of it?"
"Yes, why not?" "You will see it," Pablo said from his end of the table. "I believe that you will see it."
"Shut up," the woman of Pablo said to him, and suddenly remembering what she had seen in the hand in the afternoon, she was wildly, unreasonably angry.
"Shut up, coward. Shut up, bad luck bird. Shut up, murderer."
"Good," Pablo said. "I shut up. It is thou who commands now, and you should continue to look at the pretty pictures. But remember that I am not stupid."
The woman of Pablo could feel her rage changing to sorrow and to a feeling of the thwarting of all hope and promise. She knew this feeling from when she was a girl,
and she knew the things that caused it all through her life. It came now suddenly, and she put it away from her, and would not let it touch her, neither her nor the Republic. And she said, "Now we will eat. Serve the bowls from the pot, Maria."